you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Mark Hackard back on the show. Mark is an independent foreign policy analyst. He studies the intersection of political culture, religion, and strategic issues, which he approaches from a traditionalist conservative perspective. Mark's online project is Soul of the East, a website dedicated to introducing the English-speaking world to valuable aspects of Russian political and religious thought. Anything else to add to that, Mark?
Just my website, Espionage History Archive.
Okay, Espionage Archive. Is that espionagearchive.com?
Espionagehistoryarchive.com.
I'm sorry. Espionagehistoryarchive.com. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, of course, that's where I ran into the article. You penned this article recently, Victor Rothschild, Soviet Spy. This article, Victor Rothschild, of course, he's a scion of this legendary or infamous banking family. It sort of is the symbolizes, what we talk about, the banker elite, or perhaps even the Illuminati, some might say. This the sort of the shadowy elite that controls affairs from behind the scenes, with using their vast wealth to pretty much buy politicians, control the media, pretty much control information, the governments and these things. So this article, Victor Rothschild, Soviet Spy, let's get into it. What does it say about his family, or the Cold War, perhaps the entire 20th century?
Well, I think it's a fascinating piece of news that people should take into account, and it's a new revelation. The first break in that case, or in the matter of Rothschild, as to whether he really was a Soviet asset, came in 2016, when the memoirs, or not even the memoirs, but the diaries of the former head of the KGB, Ivan Serov. He was the first head of the KGB from 1954 to 1958. His diaries, which he had secretly kept, were published, and the diaries were supposedly only discovered in 2012, and then released to the public. And of course, and that this was through the FSB, and the guy who edited the diaries is a guy named Alexander Hinstein, and he's a he's kind of a political figure on the Russian scene. He's he's been involved in the Duma, and right now he's on the I think he sits on the he's kind of an advisor for the Russian National Guard, which is kind of like their gendarmes. But anyway, he's deeply connected. But Hinstein was the guy who edited it, and we can surmise that not all of Sirov's diary entries were published, you know, and made available to wider readership. But nonetheless, what was released is very interesting, and one of the major passages. It's a short one, but among the other very interesting entries is the fact that Sirov reveals that Rothschild was a Soviet asset from the 30s to the early stages of the Cold War, and he also says that he did not trust Rothschild. And that Rothschild was basically using the Cambridge Five, which were an infamous spy ring in British history, which included the notorious Kim Philby. That Rothschild was using the Cambridge Five to feed information to Moscow, including disinformation, and he didn't completely trust Rothschild, and that. After the formation of the State of Israel, Rothschild no longer was interested in working with Soviet intelligence. So that kind of says a lot about the Rothschild dynasty, what they were pursuing with regard to the creation of Israel, and they're sort of playing all sides of the great game. In order to achieve their goals.
Yeah, because obviously Rothschild, the Rothschild family's role in Israel is undisputed, right? I think the Balfour Declaration was written to Rothschild's father or uncle, right?
The Balfour Declaration was written to Victor Rothschild's uncle, okay. Walter. So yeah, Uncle Walter Rothschild. He was the man to whom the declaration was addressed and open. So, yeah, that's not in dispute, and it's not in dispute in Israel. You know, they're considered, you know, the major, along with, you know, the big Zionist figures like Herzl, people like that. They're right up there as kind of the founding lights of the State of Israel.
Mm-hmm. So a figure like Victor Rothschild, now he very prominent in the British establishment. Can you quickly go over what was his role in the British establishment, say, in this critical period, the late 30s, 40s, and into the 50s?
Right. What's interesting is that Rothschild was at the very heart of the British establishment. You could even say that later on, when he kind of became the kind of a gray cardinal of UK politics, that he was the establishment for all intents and purposes. Rothschild was immensely powerful, you know, due to the fact that he was representative of this financial dynasty that was very much tied in with the House of Windsor and so on. But Rothschild himself is interesting because he during the war was working in MI5, British Counterintelligence, and he was responsible for Winston Churchill's personal security. He even tasted his food. He was one of the people who did taste tests for Winston Churchill's food. And after the war, he was involved in the energy industry, stuff like BP, as well as just strategic policy planning for the United Kingdom and within the context of NATO and the Cold War, things like that. So that gave him immense field of vision to apply as sort of a player on whether that be on the international scene or in UK domestic politics. He was a big fish in a big pond.
I guess it would be correct to say he's sort of a British version of a Nelson or David Rockefeller.
I think that's a great comparison. Yeah, that's it's very much a parallel. Just like the Rockefellers themselves, also a financial dynasty, were involved in intelligence and the creation of the CIA as well. So that makes perfect sense.
And also just their involvement in this sort of this union between, well, finance, oil, the energy sector, intelligence, natural resources. These things all come into play, play an important part in being able to control the flow and distribution of these resources. And ultimately means how you can pretty much throttle or control the global economy and control the distribution of power, right? So,
yeah, you bet. Yeah. And it also shows the hierarchy of values in the modern West when you look at the intelligence services, where they come from, you know, from, say, take the OSS/CIA as an example. You know, it comes from Wall Street law firms and from the banking sector, and that's how U.S. intelligence got its start. What that means is that the intelligence services are officially, at least, an instrument of the state, right, of national security policy. But what is their real mission? They are serving the financial elites. So that really, see, in other systems, say just kind of an authoritarian state where it's not controlled by some bankster elite, the intelligence services will function, you know, as sort of the intelligence and security arm of that governing elite. But here, the governing elite is the financial class, is the banker. So that means, so that's crucial because it shows, again, it's the reality of oligarchy. Just like liberal democracy is basically the political superstructure of oligarchy, so too the intelligence services, while officially supposedly serving the best interests of the country, are actually serving the best interests of financial elites.
Yeah, and we can see that played out in a good illustration of this a relationship, or how the intelligence agencies actually serve the financial elite or the corporations. This is on the American side. Of course, it involved the British, of course, but you can see Guatemala in 1954, that was for the benefit of United Fruit. And just what happened, the Dulles brothers were on the board, and their law firm represented United Fruit. And of course, you have
imagine that coincidence.
In Iran, you have the Seven Sisters, BP, or it became BP after that, but
Roosevelt and the Rent-A-Mob. Yeah.
And all these things. So, yeah, it's just happens these operations actually directly benefit corporations, and it's done under the cover of the Cold War, and it's to justify these interventions, national security, the cover of national security. They wrap
well as long as it's for the cause of freedom, you know, that's what really matters.
Yes, Operation Freedom everywhere. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It should be Operation Freedom everywhere. So with the Rothschilds, this, of course, he's, you know, at the top of the British establishment, he's this wealthy banking family. He's supposedly serving the crown. Of course, the crown's heavily in debt to the Rothschild family. We have the Cold War that it supposedly broke out after the Second World War because just unforeseen circumstances, I suppose. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Just so happened. Yeah. That, you know, they looked the two sides, East and West, looked at each other the wrong way, and it was just a tragic misunderstanding.
Yeah. No one could foresee that by, you know, fighting Germany to the to unconditional surrender and bringing the Red Army into the heart of Europe would create such a situation. They, I guess they couldn't look at a map, right? So I think it was the War and Peace Studies that the Council of Foreign Relations report, I think funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, pretty much predicted the post-war settlement, right? I mean, they kind of called for this. All the, you know, U.S. involvement in Europe, permanent involvement in Europe, you know, through NATO and these things. But this was actually, I think, 1938 or 39 that all this is being set up.
Right. The dialectic of the Cold War was kind of being set up, and the architecture was being forged. So if you look at someone like Halford Mackinder, and he would die shortly thereafter, but his 1943 essay, which I think was published in Foreign Affairs, is really kind of sheds light on the matter, where he again, you know, talks about the same goals of you know, containing the heartland and you know, ensuring the security of the Western democracies, which really, I mean, in brutal language, that just means what we know today is you know, further encroachment into you know, sovereign nations' affairs, and
yeah,
further, you know, further destabilization, further war,
and calling for the encirclement of Russia and the I guess the destruction of German power, independent German power.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And hence we get two wars that do that, coincidentally, of course.
Right. Right. Yeah. No. History is just one series of events after another, and there's no logical chain behind it. Yeah.
Yet people like Mackinder write these things like geopolitical pivot of, what was that, 1904 article?
The geographical pivot of world history. Yeah. 1904, and democratic ideals and reality. And Mackinder, of course, he has, I mean, his work is phenomenal in the sense of him, if you look at it just from a sort of a diagnostic point of view, but his prescriptions are those of the sort of the Atlanticist elites. Mm-hmm. And that means the oligarchy that controls the West, you know, the sort of the bankster international. So, that's where you can view geopolitics as the application of political power to the geographical space. But what the dangerous thing is when rather than just viewing it analytically is when they give policy prescriptions, here's what needs to, they're essentially saying, here's what needs to happen next, and here's how we're going to do it. And then you see it play out before you on the television screens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're not always successful, though. So if you look at, I mean, Syria is still, that's the current conflict that's burning, but it does not look like the Western Gulf Israeli alliance is going to get its way in Syria. So that's and they may try to still yet start a big war over this, but they're not succeeding there. So they're not unassailable.
Yeah, I mean, there's internal contradictions in the policy, because on one hand you have this NATO alliance that they're trying to maintain despite losing all reason to exist, even the pretext,
right,
which was the Cold War. But by pursuing this policy in Syria, they're aggravating Turkey, which is the most powerful, at least land force on NATO, because of the Kurdish issue. So the more they push this, the more they alienate Turkey and push it in.
Yeah. And the more the contradictions become apparent, and it's just becoming an enormous mess. And yeah, they're playing with fire.
Which might serve some other people's interest, because in the meantime, you get to fire off 100 missiles at $10 million a pop.
Yeah, and then your stock goes up billions of dollars. So.
Yeah, yeah, like Theresa May's husband or something owns.
Yeah,
yeah. This is how the power. They're all integrated into the system. They all make money off war. But one point in your article, bringing back to Victor Rothschild and Kim Field, it's very interesting. Is that Explain how he played a role in Philby's exposure and how he sort of manipulated it to make sure that Philby was exposed, but not when he was in Britain. He was able to escape to Russia.
Right.
And the reason why he did that, which might have something to do with his objective regarding the Israeli state. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's a complex web that was woven with regard to Philby's escape and Rothschild and the whole entire Middle East conflict with Israel and the Palestinians and the Arab states and with that within the context of the Cold War. Philby was basically with the Cambridge Five consisted of Philby, Kim Philby, and then there was Guy Burgess, Donald McLean, and John Cairncross and Anthony Blunt. And in 1951, Guy Burgess and Donald McLean fled. They defected to the Soviet Union, and that exposed Philby. Now, he was not per se totally blown as a spy, but he was there was a big cloud of suspicion over him, and he was forced to resign from his high post in MI6, British intelligence, and he was basically kind of left hanging for a while. Well, he made his way by the mid late 1950s, he made his way to Beirut, and he was working as a journalist, kind of a stringer journalist, for British newspapers like the Independent and the Observer. And I mean, he had Philby's previous, previous profession, this goes back to like Spain, the Spanish Civil War. He was a journalist there, I think for the Times. When he was a Soviet agent, he was posing as a pro-Franco journalist. And so Philby, was in effect, as part of his cover, he was long experienced being a journalist. So he was writing for newspapers there. Well, he was also, he had kind of regained the trust of some faction of MI6, and he was working there as an unofficial, kind of an MI6 asset. He was no longer an MI6 officer, but he was working as an asset. And of course, he had also reestablished contact with the KGB, whose residency was right there in Beirut. And his eventual unmasking came, I think it was around nine. Okay, so this is important. The figure of Anatoly Galitsyn pops up, and I think I've discussed Galitsyn before, either with you or with Jay Dyer, but Galitsyn was a Soviet defector. I think he was a KGB major who came over. He might have been a colonel who came over, and he is credited with giving up Philby. But the real nail in the coffin for Philby came when a woman called Flora Solomon exposed Philby. She told someone about Philby being a Soviet spy, because about 25 or so years prior, in the 1930s, Philby had tried to recruit her into Soviet intelligence, and he gave her some line about being on the front lines of the secret fight for international peace or something like that. But it was clear it was Soviet intelligence. And Flora Solomon, who was a British Jew, I think she had roots in Russia. She was an ardent Zionist. So why did she report Philby? She reported Philby in the early 1960s because she was pissed off about Philby's editorial slant, writing in these newspapers for British audiences. He was writing from a pro-Arab slant as opposed to a pro-Zionist slant, and which was, the pro-Arab slant is, has been very common for decades upon decades among British journalists or even British civil servants and Arabists. You know, they're often quite friendly to the Arab point of view, but nonetheless, you know, official policies of the British government, you know, may, you know, try to have some seeming balance between the Israelis and the Arabs. But Philby was writing anti-Israeli slanted articles, and Flora Solomon was incensed at this, and so she told none other than Victor Rothschild, because he was known as a big guy in the he was a major figure in the British counterintelligence establishment. Still, you know, he still had a lot of power and all the connections. So she informed Victor Rothschild about Philby, and that kind of set in motion a renewed MI5 investigation into Philby. At the same time, when MI6 was sending down a team of officers to interrogate Philby, and around that same period, what's interesting is that after Flora Solomon warned Roth, or rather informed Rothschild that Philby, she thought Philby was a Soviet spy, Anthony Blunt, one of the members of the Cambridge Five, who was largely not spying anymore. He was actually a cousin of the royal family, and was a big art connoisseur, and he was the keeper of the Queen's pictures, I think is the official title. So he was in charge of the royal art galleries, and Anthony Blunt just happened to show up in Lebanon and visit Philby right before the time when Philby escaped. So the question comes into play: who exactly sent Anthony Blunt to warn Philby? Because that's effectively what happened, is that Blunt came and warned Philby. It wouldn't be the KGB, because the KGB had a residency there, right in Beirut, and they could have warned Philby through various signals or potential meets. They didn't need to do that. And then Philby also had a control officer, a guy named Mojin, who had spoken with him earlier and had advised him to be cautious because the net looked like it was tightening. So the KGB didn't need to send Blunt to warn Philby. So that means, so who did send Blunt? Well, I mean, Rothschild was just informed about it, and Rothschild remained a good friend with Blunt. And Blunt and Rothschild, along with Guy Burgess, were all members of the Apostles, which was a Cambridge student society that basically was in the 1930s, was very much oriented towards Marxism and was also known for its homosexual activity. So they were all involved in the Apostles. And it would make sense that Blunt was actually sent by Rothschild to Lebanon to warn Philby. And then shortly thereafter, Philby made his escape. What's also interesting is that Blunt's reason for going down to Beirut was for a botanical trip. He was going on this excursion to find the frog orchid. But then when you look, this is interesting. There's a good documentary on this, and it's listed among the sources in my article. But the frog orchid doesn't grow anywhere in Lebanon, in the Middle East. It grows in England, but not in Lebanon. So that's kind of a bogus reason to go down there. So that immediately casts more suspicion on what Blunt was up to. So so that really kind of points to Rothschild sending Blunt down to warn Philby, which means that Rothschild wanted Kim Philby to escape, because if Philby was actually caught and brought back to Britain, he could reveal all kinds of secrets if he was so pressured. And that would expose Rothschild himself, who it has been revealed by Ivan Sirov, who was the first head of the KGB, that Rothschild was indeed a Soviet asset.
Hmm. And yeah, and so it was a mixture of Rothschild trying to, I guess, cover up his trail, cover up evidence of his treachery, of even greater treachery than no one could really imagine. But also the politics surrounding the Zionism, the founding of the Israeli state, this lady having much greater loyalty to Zionism than to her home country, Great Britain.
Well, she was definitely, that's where her heart was. Sure. Yeah. For Solomon, and she got really pissed off when Philby was writing his pro Arab articles.
So yeah, when he was a Soviet spy, she didn't seem to care too much. But,
and what's interesting, she had her son went on to found Amnesty International. So she's obviously, you know, a smart lady and talented and accomplished family, and they you know, they're not just nobodies. And in fact, one of the authors of a book on Philby, I'm forgetting. He wrote A Spy Among Friends, and I'm forgetting his name right now, but it's a good book. It's called A Spy Among Friends. He talks about, he goes into this in detail about Flora Solomon and kind of, you know, this was the main reason, for her, you know, telling Rothschild. There were some other reasons as well. Flora Solomon was friends with Philby's wife as well, and Philby was awful to his wives. He didn't treat any of them well. He was a bit of a philanderer and of course a drunk. So that probably figured into it. But really, what set her off was Philby's articles that were unfriendly to Israel. So that kind of, you know, made it kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back. And Rothschild's role then is really, yeah, what could Philby have revealed besides just, sort of the rudimentary passing of secrets? You know, what was Rothschild up to? He was definitely playing a greater game than just spying for the Soviets per se. I mean, of course he flirted with Marxism in his youth, just like a lot of these Cambridge and Oxford students back in the 1930s, 1920s, 1930s, but it doesn't seem like he was a starry-eyed Marxist.
Mm-hmm.
His family's dream was to set up a Jewish state. That was clear. So you know, kind of manipulating the balance of power and playing one nation off against another in this, you know, intricate diplomatic and intelligence game in this arena, ultimately, you know, could benefit their goal. So that's, I think that, and that's what Sirov says anyway, that the family, that was their objective, and they achieved it, you know. That and during the late 1940s, the Soviet Union was, in fact, instrumental in helping the state of Israel get established, because Eastern Bloc arms, in particular from the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia, played a big role in tipping the scales in favor of the Israelis against the Arab armies.
Yeah.
And of course you had numerous Ashkenazi Jewish emigres, and some of these people already had combat experience. They had fought either as partisans or they had fought in the Red Army against the Nazis, and so they were then allowed to go down and fight for the state of Israel. And this was from Stalin's point of view, this would be a friendly, at the very least, a friendly state on in the Levant, and potentially a new sort of communist satellite. Things did not turn out that way because, again, the Rothschild family was so important and instrumental in setting up the state of Israel, and the Rothschild family ultimately saw Soviet communism as a tool, you know, not as like an end in itself. Their allegiance was to setting up this new country, not having it serve the interests of the Soviets. So it was really a matter of who is playing whom, and there's all sorts of different intrigues and back and forth games that are played, and we can go into that some as well. But because Rothschild was in fact feeding the Cambridge Five, he was giving the Soviets information through the Cambridge Five, and the Soviets knew not to trust him fully, and that speaks to something too. So it's not like in the Cold War dialectic, it's not as if both sides immediately work for the same master, but it's more a matter of manipulating, shaping events, shaping the dialectic by these major banking dynasties and these elites in power. They know how to sort of shape the conflict, you know, to manage the conflict for their own ends.
Yeah, and that's what you got, with the Russian Revolution, which would have been possible without the First World War.
Right.
And, of course, the trauma and crisis brought about by the First World War leads to the Second World War. Both those crises or events made the creation of the Israeli state possible, Israel possible. Without those events, you wouldn't have had Zionism, wouldn't have had that the political capital to
right
you know, to be manifested, right? I mean, the state.
Yeah, it was forged in war and by you know by settlers and by these war refugees and veterans, and you know these were tough people, but it's not just a matter of them, you know, going down there and taking control. There were maneuvers at much higher levels that enabled the state of Israel to come into being, you know, both east and west, you know, kind of because at the time, of course, the Soviets were, you know, hoping for sort of a Soviet friendly state in the Middle East, you know, in the Eastern Mediterranean, while at the same time, the state of Israel, in order to sustain itself and survive as a viable state in a hostile region, say, needed more support long term than maybe they calculated the Soviets could or would give. And the fact that they needed a strong they needed a, not just a major power, but a major power with a wealthy Jewish diaspora who could help them.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Hollywood of New York.
So United States.
Yeah, United States, yeah.
Was that country.
Yeah.
And that would kind of become cemented in the, you know, later in the 1960s. But
and Las Vegas, yeah. So don't forget Las Vegas. It was it Mo Dalitz and Hank Greenspun and...
I'm not sure. I haven't read too much on the history of Las Vegas.
Well, there's a lot of the, you know, because the Jewish gangsters in Las Vegas and all of the the Meyer Lansky and the illegal arms shipments that came in.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very interesting there. And But yeah, but what's interesting, Zionism itself, because yeah, anything, the ideology of Zionism, then the states form. Yeah, you have the idea, then the state's created. Then the state itself needs to, I guess, justify itself. But ideology begins to take a back seat because there are more practical concerns. And they realized there's more money in the West, there's more security by getting money from Jewish financiers in the West than aligning themselves with the Soviet Union. But one thing that's interesting, Zionism itself as a political phenomenon is important here, but it's one thing you see with Rothschild backing it, it's sort of this, the whole diaspora Zionist claim, where anywhere where there's a Jew, there's Israel, right? They got this concept where, any Jew can go to Israel and become a citizen. In fact, they are de facto citizens. It's just a question of whether they invoke it. But that creates a problem from the standpoint of other countries, because then you have a standpoint of dual citizenship and dual loyalty. In many cases, dual loyalty might be an improvement to some of these people.
Always those conflicts of interest. Yeah, when you get a nationalism like that.
Yeah. So you're right. It plays into this post-war anti-Semitism on Stalin's part, but really Stalin, in many ways, this was sort of a typical Stalinist response to a practical problem. One is a disloyal fifth column, if you have Jews in Russia who are practicing Zionism, all of a sudden, from a standpoint of Stalin, he can't control them anymore. So what's Stalin going to do?
Stalin's going to do what Stalin always does.
Yes.
That's the sad thing that you had these within the Soviet Union in the late 1940s. There were, of course, many prominent Jews in across the spectrum of, say, from arts and culture and literature to medicine, science, and so on, that were kind of swallowed up by these purges. They weren't, say, the mass purges of 1937, 1938, anything like that, but they were nonetheless pretty brutal and driven again by Stalin's paranoia, which again, the fact that Stalin could not control the Zionist movement, that alone made it a potential threat. Mm-hmm. So when you have any issue of potential dual loyalties, then that's going to trigger a response by someone like Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the death, the assassination in 1948 is when it, even back then, even with the, as Israel was just being founded, you had the assassination of a guy named Solomon Michaels, who was a playwright, and he was the head of the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee, which was very active in World War II. Well, he was killed in a kind of in a staged car accident in Minsk by the MGB on Stalin's direct orders. And then you had the doctor's plot, which goes back to the 1948 death of Zhdanov. He was a major figure in the party, Andrei Zhdanov. And he died of a stroke, and one of his doctors wrote a letter criticizing another group of doctors who should have foreseen it, and it was kind of twisted into this entire affair, the doctor's plot, where a group of Jewish doctors, primarily Jewish doctors, was seeking to poison, high-ranking party members and Stalin himself on behalf of U.S. intelligence, kind of a, mm-hmm. An American Zionist plot. And I can tell you that U.S. intelligence did not have very good assets at all in Soviet Russia in the late 1940s or in the early 50s. They were next to nothing. as far as human intelligence goes. But so you see this kind of this tragedy unfold, and again, Stalin being paranoid would kind of just take sweeping measures against all perceived enemies, whether they had any inkling at all of any kind of any subversive intentions or not.
That's similar to like a couple of decades before you had the Kirov murder.
It was a very like Kirov's murder was a very convenient event to enact sweeping changes in the state apparatus, and unfortunately that meant blood and suffering and prison camps for lots of people.
But, yeah, I mean, the idea, I guess, was to purge the Communist Party or the Bolsheviks, the old line Bolsheviks, who might be independent from Stalin, and get rid of them, and then after that he just has a bunch of acolytes who yeah, and then takes a
right,
lot. The purges themselves take a logic of their own in the 30s, you know.
Where, yes, they really do take on it. It becomes. It just descends into madness, and just the bloodletting is so ferocious that by the late 1930s, people have to kind of come to their senses and realize that it's just tearing the state apparatus itself apart. Soviet intelligence as the specific example, Soviet intelligence, their networks abroad were just devastated. And because there were no officers to, run agents or recruit new agents or any of that. Entire residencies were just liquidated.
Yeah, it's the problem of any dictatorship, because all of a sudden you destroy all spontaneity or critical thought, and the apparatus itself collapses on itself. And
right.
Obviously, this was exposed in the summer of 1941, because it's right after the officers purged from the Red Army. You had the German onslaught, and much of that was probably because of lack of talented military leadership, and they had to bring
right. Yeah, no, the leadership, the general staff was definitely weakened by all the purges, for sure. Yeah, that has to be taken into account, for sure.
And that's when Stalin becomes the old traditionalist and starts to invoke the Orthodox Church.
Right, because no one Mother wants Russia. To die for, yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, who wants to die for proletarian internationalism? Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, yeah, it doesn't, or it doesn't quite have the same ring to it. And he found by necessity that, that Russia, of course, would fight for being Russia, and that meant, yeah, that even meant in some limited way, restoration of the Russian Orthodox Church, and traditional Russian culture.
Now, with this character Viktor Rothschild and his exposure as a Soviet asset, or his exposure as dealing with the Soviets and sort of handling the Cambridge Five and sort of feeding them information, managing the situation, sort of stage managing the Cold War, at least the espionage aspect of it, and the broader Cold War. If we go back further back in the Soviet history in the early days, as we all know that Rothschild, of course, the Rothschild-Schiff family are very closely related. These families were pivotal in financing the Bolshevik cause during the critical days of the Russian Civil War. The revolution itself, Trotsky being funded by New York and London, these
right, and the and the and the Warburgs as well.
The
right.
Warburgs, that's the German angle. So yeah. It's transnational. So we can't go by states. We have to go by banking families that have.
Yeah, and right. J.P. Morgan, Brown Brothers Harriman,
and they all have a stake in collapsing Russia and sort of treating it as an emerging market or a country to be exploited or kept down for a time being. At least that's Anthony Sutton's thesis. The Anthony Sutton thesis, we can't ignore that here, because if these families had an interest in first promoting Bolshevism and sort of discarding it when after it served its purpose.
It's kind of a massive social experiment, and in a way to centralize resources and financial flows for their eventual extraction
and create sort of a world situation, because World War One, you have this multipolar world, right? You have the you have Russia that's coming on strong, Germany as an independent industrial power, sort of out competing Britain as an economic power industrially. Britain is sort of a mercantilist economy in decline at this time. And the United States, which is being brought into the Anglo fold gradually at this point, you know, with the Pilgrim Society and the Union Now League and these things. So U.S. is aligning itself with Great Britain, at least the East Coast is. And that's all the opinion that matters from the standpoint of foreign policy at this point. The trialectics or dialectics that are created by the wars, I mean, this first World War creates a sort of the tripolar world. Then this is sort of the thesis that you get from Anthony Sutton, Carol Quigley, which his book Tragedy and Hope, which I had a lot of interviews with Jay Dyer about his series on that, how that's sort of an apologetic or manual for the global elite, Carol Quigley, when he wrote that book, that tome. But the Second World War sets the conditions for the bipolar world. And then when the colder ends, is we have the unipolar world, which is desperately trying to be held together by the Anglo-American Zio Empire,
Which is falling apart as we speak.
Yeah, desperately you're trying to keep it together and these things. I've kind of lost myself there. That was just a train of thought. How basically, here's a good example: George Kennan, right, Mr. X.
Mm-hmm.
He writes that telegram, which sets the stage for the Cold War. It creates the justification for containment.
Right, containment policy.
Which is pretty much just an excuse for intervention everywhere, huge, massive budgets and perpetual debt, oligarchic rule through bank debt. That's which is what these wars create. His father, or uncle rather, supported the Bolsheviks.
Yes. It's very interesting. Yeah, he was like a Presbyterian missionary or something that effect.
I think it was on Jacob Schiff's payroll or something.
Very interesting. Yeah, I did not know that. But he, of course, was supportive of the revolutionary cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to show that, the very strange, but when you examine it closely, fully logical relationship between capitalism and revolution. The point being that capitalism, international capitalism, is the ultimate revolution.
Mm-hmm.
what we see today is the constant upheaval, destabilization, right down to details in our own lives and the breakup of the family. As I was discussing previously with Jay Dyer, this is not the breakup of the family was not here in the West was not cultural Marxism. This was this is done by multinational corporations.
Yeah, and that's that talk with Jay Dyer about that, and you talk about it's the Golitsyn and the Besmirov.
Yeah, Bismyanov.
How he tried to treat it as sort of a communist conspiracy to morally corrupt America through Elvis Presley or something. As you pointed out, this is a corporate Western banker agenda. I mean, right? I mean, we see today. And the cultural Marxism was imported. Germans were brought
imported
in from the OSS.
To the West. Yeah. Yes,
and they went to Hollywood and New York and these things. These very American.
Right, with the full support of the Rockefellers and academia and the foundations.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and that's if you look at what occurred in the West: the sexual revolution, the creation of suburbia, the destruction of ethnic neighborhoods, and these things.
Yeah, that wasn't communism.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Yeah, that wasn't the Reds. Of course, you had back then the Red Scare, which was sort of a misdirection at the power of the foundations. who could play both sides and support both socialism and right wing causes when it suited them. But you can look at today and see us in the midst of another Red Scare, and we love to sort of hear and say our modern, the Western environment, talk about if we're, you know, looking over history, how, oh, you know, the look at the Soviets and their terrible purges, or look at the, you know, what the Nazis did. And yeah, that stuff was utterly terrible. But you can see the exact same type of paranoia has permeated our political environment. Mm-hmm. To this entirely fake Russiagate so-called affair that leads exactly nowhere and is only used as a prop in some sort of internal political struggle. It very much smacks of the sorts of crazy plots that were put on or that were rather given as fact at the show trials in Moscow during the 30s, you know, where all these improbable coalitions and alliances would come together between Soviet internal political factions, as well as multiple foreign intelligence services and international capital, you know, all to undermine, you know, the Soviet state. Well, I mean, these of course were choreographed by Stalin and people like Bushinsky. But we're seeing we don't have the casualties and bloodshed yet, thank God. But nonetheless, the political environment is just as paranoid and really absurd and crazy, just given the level of degradation that we're at in popular culture.
Yeah, and that's completely a Western project. It's a
yes,
you know, the you talk about the you know, the Rockefellers and their promotion of characters like Alfred Kinsey and even Hugh Hefner, you know.
Yeah,
and it's not coming from the East, it's the West.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Gloria Steinem wasn't working for the KGB.
No, she wasn't. You know? So, but nevertheless, we're supposed to be worried about, you know, the corruption. But ironically, I think, as you pointed out in your discussion with Jay Dyer, is the if you, cultural conservatism, that's something that's much stronger in the East, because
yes,
you know, the Iron Curtain did protect him somewhat.
Interestingly enough, yes, yeah. it's a really strange thing if you just look at it through the lens of, say, a Western conservative. Why would the Soviet bloc? Why would their culture, meaning their traditional culture, be more intact? And that's not to say that they also suffered plenty of dislocations and
the
family also suffered over there, because it did. And you know, and especially in the breakup in the 1990s, it was awful. But nonetheless, why is traditional culture in the former Soviet bloc doing all right and actually pushing back, whereas here it's just a nonstop sort of carnival of destruction. I think it really is interesting that give the example with Stalin or you know, other Soviet leaders, they were not interested. I mean, they wanted stable families that produced enough children, and you know, it's a very strange paradox, but the Soviets actually supported a lot of folk culture, and there were reasons for that that had to do with the supposed stages of development through a Marxist prism of history. But they were supportive of arts and culture and sort of remembering traditional folk ways, or even creating whole cloth, like creating literary languages for tribes or nations that had none previously. It was kind of an amazing thing.
I mean, they actually like provided written languages.
Yes.
Well, that's something similar to something like with the Jesuits did, the South American tribes.
It's an interesting in places like Central Asia and in the Caucasus and in across the expanses of Siberia. Peoples were encouraged to retain their identity and keep that, which is kind of stunning, just if you take kind of a basic, superficial view of what we know of the Soviet experiment, it is sort of contradictory, but nonetheless, they were sort of the Soviets and the countries of the Soviet bloc were sort of inoculated in some way to what the West would bring in the post Cold War period, not to a complete, like, countries on the Western fringes like Poland and Czech Republic are certainly more susceptible to this stuff in some ways, mm-hmm. but you do see nonetheless a stronger emphasis on national culture, identity, national sovereignty, things like that. The inherent good of the family, things that shouldn't be taken for granted. But unfortunately, here in the West, it's affairs have gone far downhill.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that. If you have an identity, particularly an ethno-religious identity, and that is manifested in a state and territory, you have a defense against sort of the toxic culture of the West, which is your idea of the West, where these things aren't supposed to, we're supposed to be at least America, it's a proposition nation, so there's no ethno-religious basis to being an American. And that's
right. You could fly down from some far off planet in outer space and theoretically become an American.
And open up
America is an amazing country in so many ways. But yeah, the foundation, when people talk about, oh, America's an idea, it's not a land or a people, it's an idea. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, you're turning it into a bloodless abstraction.
Yeah.
Swallows everything it consumes.
And that lack of identity means that people are effectively atomized or divided. And they're easily manipulated by the oligarchs, right, who control the levers of economic and cultural power.
That's exactly how it's devised, I think. Yeah,
there's an example like in Poland where there's been a lot of pushback from sort of the Western culture, gay rights and these things, sexual liberation, and some of the protests that you might see in the West have no effect in Poland. Because the Poles identify themselves as Polish Catholics,
right?
And there are similar
things going on in Russia. The Russian Orthodox Church has kind of slowly but steadily regained, made its imprint on Russian culture, felt again, and more people were, kind of trickling back in, which is good. And places like Bulgaria,
Hungary,
Hungary, certainly you have there kicking out Western NGOs and
one thing that Putin recently did within the last few years, and it's considered illiberal by Western standards, but he kicked out Jehovah's Witnesses and the Scientology. Because people who are savvy to these type of missionary work, these are assets for Western intelligence. These aren't,
of course, yes. They function as fronts for intelligence operations. That's a given. And it doesn't take too much. You don't have to be too clever to figure that one out. But and they're also tremendously destructive to the national fabric. Wherever these toxic cults go, they inevitably will play a role in undermining the society as is constituted in favor of, you know, kind of dissolving it and setting up some kind of, you know, paradise for multinationals to come in and prey on people.
Yeah, and put in their, you know, their corporate, their chain restaurants, you know. So
yeah,
a food court in Moscow looks just looks just the same as a food court in a mall in Houston, Texas, or something.
Yeah, yeah, and that's that. Unfortunately, that is just that's an unfortunate reality of you know, I mean, you could, you know, whether east or west, you know, I mean, Moscow is tremendously cosmopolitan, and I mean, it retains still a lot of its character, but you know, you also have these enormous, shining skyscrapers that, you know, look exactly like skyscrapers, whether they be in Dubai or, you know, Tokyo or Boston or where. I mean, it's, you know, there's always that standardization at work, but it is nonetheless important to kind of push back against the deeper, you know, cultural and spiritual aspects of that, which are so poisonous.
Yeah, yeah, and because you want the global monoculture, because that way it makes, at the very least, it makes marketing easier.
Right? Yeah, no, yeah, which is what I mean. What is marketing? But it's another application of psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Rothschild. Here he is. He's Victor Rothschild, head of Soviet, British intelligence. He's
he was a major. He was high up in MI5.
Yeah,
yeah.
And here he is.
Considered a wise man of British intelligence later on,
and he's feeding intelligence to the Soviet Union, sort of managing this stuff. I mean, is that kind of sort of like a does that symbolize the entire Cold War, that type of relationship?
Yes, a bit. I would say because the Cold War dialectic was, as you alluded to, sort of set up with the outcome of World War II, and you know, the division of Europe, and that of course cannot be minimized on either side, that you know, soldiers, whether the Red Army or the US or the British or you know, whoever, whatever nation, you know, fought and died so that you know, there could be some semblance of peace. I mean, it was, you know, it made a divided world, and that divided world kind of came into being because I don't think it was the original plan, but really, if you look at the kind of the founding of the UN, the United Nations, and what the major the people who matter in the West, people like Rockefeller or Bernard Baruch, you know, the major heads of financial dynasties, what they wanted was a world government, and that's what the UN was supposed to be. And
that shouldn't be a controversial statement. What you just said there.
No, not at all.
Some people will hear that and say, "Well, this guy's a conspiracy theorist."
Oh yeah, but, well, what is it? Yeah, UN world government. I mean, of course, yeah, that's why the UN was set up.
Yeah, but the son, the banking family, Wahlberg, in 1947, yeah, say we'll have world government, whether by consent or by force. Either way, we'll have
it.
In front of the Senate, in front of the U.S. Senate,
right.
He says this.
Right. and that's always, you know, that seems to be, in the interest of, transnational banking and commercial elites, because they can move, you know, money, resources, people, you know, entire demographic, yep, flow, like you're seeing with the refugee crisis in the Middle East, which was brought on by these unjust wars. They can move all these across borders and, you know, shape the world to their liking.
Yeah, I mean, if your workers have organized and now they're demanding higher wages, well, how do we handle this? Well,
let's bring in new workers.
Yeah, just destabilize the South American country and bring them all north.
Yeah,
and we don't care what happens in the neighborhood.
And it's a bad deal for everyone.
Yeah,
yeah, and so, of course, they'll manipulate with.
But Mark, it makes economic sense.
Yeah.
This is the anomaly,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it makes economic sense for a few ultra-rich billionaires.
Yeah.
It's good for them, so we should like it too.
So, yeah. I mean, this is but this is, goes back to philosophy, sort of the British cosmology, right? The
right
that you right. talk sort about. The article,
yeah, based on Newtonian physics and, you know, Adam Smith and sort of that empirical worldview that, you know, sort of the world ends up being, you know, kind of disintegrating into quantity. And, you know, pure quantity.
Yeah, it's the world. It's gravity and inertia, and it's just physics playing out. It's not moral agents acting.
Yeah, it's not a moral universe. It's just these corporations that, you know, that exploit people. Well, they're just atoms. You know, they're just doing their thing.
It's just creative destruction. Just creative destruction.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and you can't blame the almighty market. Which, I mean, that in itself, you know, I think the best way to look at it is, and people like to blame. I mean, my issue is, I don't think, you know, I don't think we can blame one. I don't know, but, you know, I mean, plenty of people, and I've seen this, you know, want to, you know, get into the, it was the Jesuits or the Jews or whatever. I mean, look, here's the thing. This is. The best model is basically, and Jay Dyer, again, I give him credit for this. It's the model of these elites is one of criminal families or sort of criminal syndicates, organizations. That's the way they operate, at least practically. It's but they have the power of propaganda. They have the power of entire state bureaucracies at their disposal, so they can, and again, and they have academia, you know, they fund through the foundations, you know, the direction of scholarly studies and so on. So they can create nationalisms, they can engineer social movements, and
feminism, consumerism,
right, all these phenomena. They don't just appear organically. They are in fact engineered and driven in a certain direction. And, you know, I mean, what comes to my mind is that when the Wehrmacht rolled into, Kiev, say, and then came the Einsatzgruppen from the SS, and they lined up at Babi Yar, they lined up, you know, the city's Jews and were executing them. Well, there are no Rothschilds or Warburgs, you know, among those people. They were just ordinary people. So that's you know, ordinary people tend to get demonized through these ideologies and through sort of jingoism and ramping up of chauvinist type nationalism and blaming, just like we see today with the, you know, the Russia gate. You know, people are being told, you know, if you speak with a Russian, you're speaking with Putin. It's just absurd. You know, so that's kind of, or the British footballers who are told that, watch out for the Russian woman. You know, they're working for the FSB, and they will.
That's another thing, is the whole idea of Russia uniquely using like sexual espionage or honey traps, and the whole Western culture is a honey trap, right? The whole Western world's a honey trap.
Yes.
Look at Hollywood, for Pete's sake. I mean,
yeah. Look at Hollywood.
You can't get away from sex. I mean, it's
yeah. This like somehow, and of course, the Russians run. They have what are called swallows and ravens, and you know, this is famous during the Cold War. With East German intelligence, Marcus Wolf was a big proponent of using ravens, meaning male sex operatives, to seduce the female secretaries. Because Harry Rositsky, who was he wrote a good book on the KGB back in the early 80s, but he was a CIA veteran, and he had a good phrase about that men get and forget, women give and forgive. And he was applying that specifically to, you know, sex and romance and things like, so, and so men, you know, will just have sex and then be like, well, so what, you know, but women get emotionally involved more often than not. And so he used, so Marcus Wolf, among others, and I think I have a story of a KGB Raven too. He was actually an Italian journalist, who was working for the KGB in West Germany during the 50s. But yeah, Wolf of the you know, the Stasi, the HVA, their foreign intelligence, used ravens to great effect and was very successful in you know, suborning these
lonely
secretaries, you know.
Yeah, wasn't Roald Dahl also known for that?
Roald Dahl was he, I don't know if, I know he was in MI9, I think. And I think he was involved in
he was part of
British intelligence.
He was part of the Irregulars over here.
Okay.
And he apparently, he was a dashing, you know, RAF officer and apparently played a role in sort of in getting America to support Britain by involving himself with women. And there's a story, it was Kay Summersby, who was Eisenhower's British mistress, who he wanted to run away with.
Interesting. Wow.
And this is post-war, but this is an account where President Truman was trying to sell the Cold War agenda, the Truman Doctrine, to Republican Senator Arthur Vandenberg. And he was a, you know, traditional Midwestern non-interventionist isolationist Republican, skeptical of these things. But upon hearing Harry Truman's plan, he supposedly told the president, well, Harry, you better scare the hell out of the American people. He was considered to be an opponent to these things, to these interventionist schemes. But he apparently switched his position on it 180 degrees after spending an evening with a blonde woman. So.
And, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously they had the goods on him.
Yeah. So, and that's how policy is made.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's not this clean process like you're given in your civics textbook. Oh, you have the three branches of government, you know, and and there's checks and balances. No, it's done through espionage, yeah. Blackmail, and overreaction.
Yeah, but my point is to somehow pin the Russians as being uniquely evil when it comes to using sex as a weapon, really, exploiting women. Really, so, I mean, the whole Western culture is based on exploiting women sexually, and I don't. Again, I'm not treating this isn't a feminist critique, because I think women are a big part of letting themselves be exploited.
That's part of the dialectic.
You have,
especially when the establishment supports both figures like Gloria Steinem and Hugh Hefner.
Yeah, or Marilyn Monroe.
Or Gloria Steinem posing in Playboy.
Yeah, you know, doing that. Or just the idea of the Hollywood starlets, you know, they're one minute they're, you know, they're sex objects and they're marketing themselves with that. Then they're raging feminist, you know.
Right.
You know, maybe part of that is psychology, but that's all part of the sort of the Well, I think sort of that the dissonance or internal contradiction of that is a whole part of the psychological warfare that you get with the sexual revolution and the whole Rockefeller agenda. Sexual liberation is a weapon for political control, and people don't recognize if you give into your passions and you become a slave to your passions, and those people who are in the position to satisfy your appetites can control you.
That's exactly right.
You know, and that's what the whole Western project seems to be about. Largely is be enslaving people to consumerism and debt and these things, and part sex is a huge part of that.
Right. That really is the religion of Mammon. Now whether it be through, I mean, just you know, capitalist theory that, you know, that somehow everyone being greedy will ultimately work out for the greater good.
Yeah.
No, people are enslaved to their passions, and it's inherently destructive. So it will lead to, as we see, it leads to the disintegration of the culture.
And this is reason why the Western Project, the Masonic Western Project, is so hostile to traditional culture, is because it's through traditional culture expressed through ethnic identity and religion. These are firewalls or stumbling blocks or bulwarks against, you know, the blandishments of Hollywood and Madison Avenue and these things. And they have to be denigrated and characterized in very unflattering ways, like any traditional backward or retrograde or something.
Right. And all that is in the tradition of propaganda and psychological warfare. There's, you know, there's no hard, fast line dividing I mean, we see it. We may categorize it with our own eyes, but really, what is advertising? What is propaganda? What is entertainment? What is psychological warfare? All those things can be fit into one.
Yeah, and even with the Soviet Union, these things, even the Germans, the Nazis, their propaganda was so crude compared to propaganda of one thing, the British, then the Americans, and it's become so well. We've internalized it to the point we don't even recognize that.
You know, right. It's given as reality when we think of propaganda. Right. We think of clumsy Soviet posters talking about the 5-year plan or some kind of Third Reich. Like Leni Riefenstahl or something like that.
Triumph of the will.
It's much more subtle.
Something.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, when you think about what's more powerful, Triumph of the Will, or your typical television sitcom displaying some sort of dysfunctional blended family and changing ideas of what it means to have a family or live. You know, what's normal? What's normative anymore? These things, and whether it's music, entertainment, these things, and this toxic culture that's put out there is entertainment, you know.
It's amazing that it's an entire barrage of toxicity and how flexible and sustainable it has been because it is a profit-driven model. I think that explains a lot of it, but nonetheless it does seem to be atrophying. There was a good conversation with Jay Dyer the other day about I mentioned Jay because I've worked with him for so long now, but the boomer generation and
I heard that
how propaganda was really perfected during the boomer era and the boomer generation. And this is not, you know, I mean, my parents are boomers and you know, I love them more than anyone. But rather, this is to say that the entire generation was zapped with propaganda. And that really was, for some reason, that was propaganda at its most effective. Whereas today, even though the technology has been, you could say it's been advanced and the bandwidth has been expanded and it's ever more present. It seems to be atrophying and it seems to be producing diminishing returns and people are just, becoming cynical and switching off or not believing it more and more. Mm-hmm. So, it is interesting to see that how even though the full power of the media is unleashed, you could say like psychic alchemy of the entire population and mind, it doesn't seem to be succeeding the way it had been in previous generations.
It might be because now there's a marked decline in the quality of life.
Yes, I think that might have something to do with it as well.
Yeah, where people are I mean, you can only be amused and distracted for so long before it starts to have a real effect on, you know, if you grew up in a broken family or something, a single parent home, never had a father around, these things, and you don't have any siblings because you only came from a family of two or something, or you didn't have a community with kids, you know, these things. I was looking back at my childhood, how different it was in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Compared to a lot of people maybe coming up in the late 80s or 90s, and they compared to that to now, and just how much more freedom I had as a child in the 70s compared to what most kids experience today. And just sort of the, I could go off and be free, you know, goof off, t- take risks, maybe do things I shouldn't be doing. But I got lucky; I didn't get into, never got in too much trouble, nor did I get hurt. But that was a boy's life, and you could come home and there was a mom and dad there.
Yeah,
you know. But nevertheless, there was a lot of psychological warfare because my mom and dad had been raised on, you know, newsreels, and their understanding was the newspaper and these things. Then of course, then television and these things. How did that affect people with television? And
No one was questioning the Gulf of Tonkin or things like that.
No, the president said it happened. It happened.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, you go to Watergate, that created sort of a faux cynicism because Watergate was sort of stage managed as well. It wasn't like the Washington Post had gotten to the bottom of the Watergate scandal. That was another misdirection. Another controlled dialectic, you know, limited hangout type thing. But yeah, you reach peak cynicism or something, and
the saturation point for all this stuff I think has been passed, and it's losing its effectiveness I think on more and more people. And mm-hmm. you know, if I don't know, the media doesn't know what to do with, you know, if you look at channels like Fox News, well, I mean, the average age of the viewership is something like 70.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. 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 Whenever I, it's always someone who's 70, 70, 75 years old watching that. Cause people get their information differently now. It's
right.
And so maybe it's propaganda has to be more sophisticated. It's hard to say how it will play out.
Yeah, and they're certainly trying hard, but it seems to be fragmenting.
Yeah, I see this strange memes. You know, a lot of anti-male stuff. You got that last year with Harvey Weinstein. It's kind of morphed into a anti-male campaign.
Yeah. that was clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, credit
is due.
A degenerate Hollywood, you know, power broker. Some of that's, you know, supposed
right
to be
somehow that reflects on all
all men.
Yeah, what do we do with, you know, these male pigs, because, you know, these gross Hollywood moguls or whatever, you know, up to nasty stuff.
Even things like, you know, this whole, you know, sort of the bullying thing.
There's another one.
How it becomes a crisis. When I was growing up, these were kind of altercations that people had at school that as a boy you learn to navigate and deal with.
Bullying, I mean, bullying's real. It makes me angry to, you know.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that on one end, you kids had intact families, so a kid would grow up knowing how to fight
right,
his
how
handle
to deal
it,
with those hardships.
How to deal with it. And the end is you'd have the bully perhaps being disciplined by responsible parents too.
Right.
This is the problem when you break apart the family, is it's almost like I've heard the analogy, right? I actually borrowed it from someone, but it's almost like when you split the atom, it's almost like you release this energy and so many things ripple from it. The society begins to break down because in the past, these things were handled kind of informally. The institutions were there to handle these things without having you know policy, these, you know, without having zero tolerance policies in these things. I mean, I used to have like fights in the playground, and a teacher wouldn't even intervene. It would just stop. And
yeah, by my time it was a little bit different, but nonetheless it is very strange because the noise about bullying is, it seems like bullying is just, it's used as a cudgel to put certain social agendas.
Yeah. It's almost like they seem to do like with rape becomes sexual, you know, with someone charged with rape, all of a sudden someone's charged with sexual misconduct. What is that? You know,
right.
Whereas bullying, I mean, obviously if you have the classic, someone's being assaulted or something, you obviously want intervention, but it gets all thrown into the same, bundle. It doesn't mean anything anymore, you know.
Well, yes, because, and it's just strange because anything will be construed as bullying and will be used for a teaching moment.
Yeah.
And social engineering.
Yeah, so that's like the internet bullying. You know, whatever happened to sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then because everyone's so delicate, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, people are taught that if they come across an opposing opinion, they're supposed to recoil in horror and break down.
Yeah, it's microaggression, I think is the term.
Yeah, microaggression.
In all places, a college campus, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the university tradition of the scholastics has really come a long way.
They're produced little malice red guards. That's the idea.
Yeah.
That. So, well, Mark, final, I know we strayed a little away from Rothschild, but I think it actually is connected, because that's what we're seeing is sort of the broad cultural agenda that we're seeing promoted by families like the Rothschilds.
The best way to look at them is mafia families. I think ultimately it does have spiritual and esoteric roots that go back in history, but really these are sort of like criminal families or kind of criminal elites, you know, these syndicates that have the power of the state at their disposal and can sort of fashion and engineer ideologies and turn, you know, groups of people against each other and get, you know, one group hating the other and, you know, whether that be men and women or different ethnicities or, you know, with the goal of breaking up the family or, creating wars to stimulate refugee flows and sort of waging demographic warfare that way. It's sort of high crimes on a grand scale. You know, all the world's a stage.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And when you affect a character like Rothschild's, which is exposed by this, Serov in his diary, is that he appeared to be sort of like stage managing the Cambridge Five.
Yes, which is fascinating. And Serov mentions, you know, we didn't fully trust him. And that's also that's worth noting, because in intelligence, a network will of course transmit its information to, say, you know, in this case, Moscow Center, you know. Mm-hmm. And with Serov saying they didn't fully trust them, and that's a reason why Philby, when he was when he finally made it to the USSR and, you know, expected to be feted as a great hero, but he was, you know, they were pretty low key with him, and they treated him well, but they didn't fully trust him. He didn't get KGB officer rank like he wanted, like his colleague George Blake actually did. The KGB obviously had a lot more trust in Blake, but he didn't get that, and so that kind of speaks to that suspicion, and the fact that Rothschild was feeding what they thought or what they knew to be disinformation at points. This shows in intelligence, you have what are called, what the Russians call and the Germans call it, you know, Funkspiel, or the Russians call it Radioigra or Operativnaya Igra, means like operational or radio game, where an intelligence network of, you know, say Moscow Center's, the NKVD's intelligence network in World War II, for example, the Red Orchestra in Western Europe and Germany was basically broken up or liquidated by the Gestapo. Okay, and the German counterintelligence was able to seize the leading figures of the network, but they kept it in place, and they played back essentially what was disinformation to Moscow, right? So they kept on feeding, they kept the information flowing, you know, with the under the guise that the Red Orchestra was still functioning, and kept sending information. Now the point of disinformation is that a lot of it could be good information, and that's for counterintelligence analysts to sort out. But the Soviets essentially they likely knew this, right? In the case of the Red Orchestra, and they were just milking the Gestapo for what they would send, and that operation was under the direct control of the head of Gestapo, Heinrich Mueller, which is interesting. And I can talk about that on another occasion, but the Soviets were milking the Gestapo, which had the Red Orchestra under their control, and they weren't letting on that they knew what had happened. Now, in the case of Rothschild, you could have something similar where, they were milking Rothschild in the Cambridge Five, and the Cambridge Five did produce a lot of real valuable intelligence, but at the same time, there was some element of disinformation there, and obviously mistrust arose, and that's what Sirov pointed out. So it's not a totally managed dialectic in the sense that, there was a conspiracy theorist named, what was his name? William. His name is eluding me right now. He died in 2001 in a shootout with police.
I know who you're talking about.
William Cooper, right?
Bill Cooper.
Wild Bill Cooper.
Yeah.
And Bill Cooper said that something about like the head of the CIA and KGB would meet in the Arctic Circle they would be taken to the Arctic Circle on nuclear submarines or something insane like that. No, that's not that's not the case. But of course, you have occasions like, the fact that Rockefeller could indeed land his plane in Moscow. So certainly the Soviets knew, who ruled the West, and they wanted to be on decent terms with the financial elites, mm-hmm. but they weren't under, I would say, certainly in the Stalin period and after, they were not under any kind of direct Western control. It was more of a matter of shaping the dialectic, and I mean it really is sort of a big. I mean it's inherently a gamble. The games that these banksters play.
Yeah.
It really is, you are literally, playing and, playing with and extinguishing the lives of millions in the process.
Yeah. It's like the so-called Hitler project,
Right.
Hitler, a British agent. Well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by Hitler being a British agent?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Hitler, played his role in I think ultimately serving out Anglo-American strategy, and you needed a figure like Hitler to destroy Germany, to set up the conditions of the Second World War. Someone who could be lured into invading Russia and these things.
And he still plays his part today. Single bad guy every single target of Washington foreign policy ends up being called Hitler.
Yeah. I mean, there's enough tantalizing stuff there. I think good example is, Helmut Schacht was good friends with name? The Bank of England, Montague Norman.
Montague Norman. They were both Masons.
And of course, the Freemasonic thing is an important thing, because that's where you get the organizational or relationship for subversion, the type of things that see happening with intrigue and subversion and these things, even moral subversion. If you look at the whole Masonic project, that seems like what West...
It's full spectrum subversion.
Yeah, it's full spectrum. It's about doing away with ethnic differences, doing away indifferentism, right? Promoting indifferentism, ecumenism with religions and these things,
The date for the first ecumenist... The International Religious Congress
mm-hmm.
was on September 11th, 1893, I think it was in China.
that
an interesting date to be sure.
That also broke ground for the Pentagon was September 11th, 1941. So
amazing. Yeah. So and when you see those dates over and over again, you have to question not just those, but it's mighty strange, and numerology as archaic and esoteric as that all sounds, with these types of characters, it does play its role.
Secret handshakes, smoke and mirrors, these things.
Yeah.
And that's what intelligence strategy is. It's trickery. It's smoke and mirrors. It's
absolutely.
It's magician. That's what, you know, what's his name? Go back to Elizabethan England, you know.
Yeah, John Dee.
John Dee was an alchemist and a musician, and it's all about, you know, and occulted knowledge in these things. And
right, and you know, he was into the occult, and you have to wonder, well, he was obviously, at some level, he was a scam artist, and at mm-hmm. some level, you know, who knows what kind of dark stuff he was up to, and you just, you know, it all gets very murky.
Yeah, so. Well, Mark, I had you a long time. I want to thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
So, any final comments or anything? Before I let you go,
I don't think so. Hopefully I'll have some new material pretty soon. I'm kind of mulling over what exactly to translate or write about. There's always fascinating stuff. One is, this last story was partially set in Lebanon, but I might do another one on, it's kind of an apocryphal story now about how the, how Soviet Spetsnaz killed some terrorists in Lebanon in 1985 when some employees of the Soviet embassy were taken hostage there.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
yeah. And that was actually it was a KGB operation. It was their the first chief directorate's special forces unit, Voimpel, and I have an official accounting of the, you know, kind of, or official version of the operation from the SVR. And I also have the take on it from the guy who directed it, Yuri Drozdov, who was the head of Directorate S within the KGB First Chief Directorate, which is where Voimpel was situated. So he goes into more detail, and he talks about, you know, what exactly they did, and as far as knocking off certain figures in order. But while the official version is very what would be the word, cleaned up, but still very, very interesting. So I might do that in order to show a real Russian assassination operation as opposed to the silly stuff that gets put on the news. Yeah, the Skripal affair, or whatever else they'll throw our way.
Yeah. So anything. Yeah, polonium or that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Let's paint the sushi restaurant with polonium. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark, thanks a lot. I'll let you go. That's Mark Hacker. Again, that is espionagearchive.com.
Espionagehistoryarchive.com.
Espionagehistoryarchive.com.
Yeah.
It's your primary website. Okay, well, great. Okay, well, thank you for coming on. I'll let you go. I'll post this in a few days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tim.
Take it easy. Good night, then.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
It ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. You don't. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe, if you don't know by now. When the rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window, I'll be gone. And turn it on your light, babe. The light I never know. It ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. Still I wish there was something you would do or say to try and make me change my mind and stay. We never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right.
I'm walking down that long, lonesome road, babe.
Where I'm bound, I can't tell.
But goodbye's too good a word, gal.
So I'll just say, fare thee well.
I ain't saying. Treated me unfair.
like you never did before. It ain't no use in calling.